Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the free enterprise system when we come back. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for about 6 a.m., and while his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, he puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work and then shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. Then he puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. And after cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator made in Mexico how much he can spend today. Then after setting his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany and goes looking, as he has for many months, for a good-paying American job. Then after the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV made in Japan, and then he ponders again why it is he can't find a good-paying American job. Well, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a commentary on the law in general. And it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, we're talking about the free enterprise system. There's another aspect of free enterprise. It's called free market discipline. What is it that makes the free market work? How is it disciplined to work? And the answer is right here in this little section of the booklet entitled Foundations of Liberty. Let me give you the name and number again so that you can get a copy of it. Foundations of Liberty is the title of the booklet, and it's put out by the MacArthur Institute. MacArthur Institute is located at 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, and their zip code is 61244. And if you want to put their zip code plus 4, it's 61244-4406. The editor, James R. Patrick. Phone number is 309-796-1485. Again, that's area code 309-796-1485. The MacArthur Institute, located at 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, 61244. Now, we're talking about the free enterprise system. And as it relates to market discipline, he goes on to say that contrary to socialistic tenets, the free market is the only mechanism that can sensibly, logically, and intelligently discipline production and consumption. Because it is only when the market is free that economic calculation is possible. Free pricing is the key. Then when prices are high, production is encouraged and consumption is discouraged. When prices fall, the reverse holds true. This is called supply and demand. Thus, production and consumption are always moving toward equilibrium. Shortages and surpluses are not in the lexicon of free market economics. Conceded, the above is no news to those who apprehend free market economics. They well know of its disciplinary influence as regards production and consumption. This alone warrants our support for the free market. However, the free market has two other quite remarkable disciplinary possibilities which have seldom been explored. So before making the exploration, it will be necessary to recognize the limitations of the free market. The market is a mechanism, and thus it is wholly lacking in moral and spiritual persuasion. And further, it embodies no coercive force whatsoever. In these respects, the market is without disciplinary possibilities. But like all mechanisms, the market, with its function for the economizing of time and effort, is servant alike to the good, the compassionate, and the perceptive, as well as to the evil and the inconsiderate and the oblivious. Scrupulosity is not among its characteristics. The free market is a name that we give to the economic activities. It is a shorthand term, and we might say, of a people acting freely and voluntarily, privately, cooperative, competitively. It is distinguished by universal freedom of choice and the absence of coercive force, and ideally, only defensive force, that is, government, is employed to put down fraud, violence, predation, and other aggressions. Given a society of freely choosing individuals, the market, then, is that which exists as a consequence. It is a mechanism that is otherwise non-definite. It is the procession of economic events that occur when authoritarianism, political or otherwise, is totally absent. While private enterprise is often practiced in a manner consistent or consonant with the free market principles, the two terms are not synonymous. Piracy is an enterprise, and it's also private. Many businesses, when in league with unions, for instance, willing or not, feature elements of coercion and thus are not examples of the free market at work. The free market has only been approximately, never fully attained, and doubtless never will be realized. It is an out-of-reach ideal that we can only move toward or away from, and yet here in the United States, even in these days of a rapidly growing interventionism on the part of government, the free market flourishes to a remarkable extent. And to appreciate this, merely envision the countless willing exchanges, hundreds of millions of exchanges daily, such as Mrs. Jones swapping a shawl that she has made for a goose Mrs. Smith has raised, or the money you pay for a phone call or a quart of milk. In these instances, each party gains, for each desires that which he gets more than that which he surrenders. In a word, the free market is individual desire, speaking in exchange terms. When the desire for Bibles is accommodated in non-coerced exchange, we can conclude, quite accurately, that we are witnessing a market for Bibles. Or, when the desire for pornography is being thus accommodated, we can conclude that there is a market for pornography. I repeat, scrupulosity is not a feature of the market. So right and wrong, good and bad, moral or immoral, is not the subject matter of the marketplace. An amoral servant comes into play. When the desires of people are depraved, a free market will accommodate that depravity. And it will accommodate excellence with equal with equal alacrity, I guess, with equal force. It is servant alike to good and evil. Now, I've mentioned this a time or two. Hell, the marketplace works for cocaine, marijuana. But it also works for chickens and cows and wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. The marketplace then, in short, as we pointed out last time, if just the two of us, just you and me, were on a desert island out in the South Pacific someplace, shipwrecked, marooned like Robinson Crusoe, me, an old man, and you, a young one, you can climb those coconut trees and pick those coconuts. But I can't. I've got a disability, my old age. But because of my skill and ability, I was able to build a boat. And I went out and went fishing. Now, the free marketplace then says, I've got fish. Can I produce more fish? Well, let's suppose that a third, fourth, or fifth, or sixth person ends up on our island. As time progresses along, others that have been shipwrecked wash up on our island also. And so, here I am with my boat. Now, the other five or six of you might say to yourself, let's go take Gordon's boat away from him. He's a frail old man, let's just go take it. Well now, are you really sure that you want to do that? Has it occurred to you that maybe I've got expertise in fishing that you don't have? Maybe that expertise, along with my boat, maybe with my wisdom and old age and gray hair, might be a valuable asset to the rest of the community here. And how should we divide up our island? Should we have land titles? Should certain of us own the whole island, one or two of us, or should all of us have an equal percentage? Should we divide the whole island up six ways, or should we just take what land we need and leave the rest of it vacant and idle? I mean, these are all considerations that we need to make. Some of it's political. Some of it's economic. Some of it may be just plain based on vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. But one thing's for certain, there's six of us on the island, and six of us have to get along, or six of us have to fight with one another. And fighting and warring among ourselves typically produces poverty. It may produce some temporary benefit for the victor, but for the vanquished it produces poverty. And then you find another phenomenon that comes in here in the marketplace, and that is willingness to labor. You might stick a gun in somebody's head and tell him to climb that tree. And he might climb that tree, but is he going to climb it very fast? And how many trees is he going to climb today? And how many coconuts is he going to pick and throw down? See, these are all factors. If you can get people to willingly run up the tree, and I saw one of these South Sea Islanders climbing one of those palm trees to pick coconuts, and I got to tell you, he climbed up there like a fly. He just puts his hands and feet on that trunk, and he just started climbing. He just climbed right to the top of it. Now, not only can't I do that, I wouldn't do that. So if you were waiting on me to pick coconuts, we would all starve to death. But this division of labor comes into play. And if this labor is free and voluntary, and you can get some guy to run up that tree and pick those coconuts, and you can get me to run out there and catch those fish, all of a sudden, all of us begin to benefit. One guy maybe is growing papayas, another guy is picking bananas. One guy is growing fish, another guy is getting coconuts. Maybe another guy is over here building huts. You know, pretty soon this division of labor presents itself in the form of an economy. That is, where multiple people doing multiple tasks. Pretty soon, all of us have a house to live in. All of us have coconut. All of us have fish. All of us have bananas. All of us have passion fruit. And all of us have this higher, better standard of living. Now, that's what the free marketplace has accomplished in the past, and that's what it's accomplishing today where it's being used. And the fundamental behind this is the Ten Commandment model. The free enterprise system comes from the Bible. It comes from the Ten Commandments. And our Constitution here in the United States contains 22 principles of that law in our Constitution. Strange as that may sound. Now, it's because the free market serves evil as well as good that many people think that they can rid society of all of the evil by slaying this faithful and moral servant. This is comparable to destroying the sun because we don't like the shadows that we cast or breaking the mirror so that we won't have to see the reflection of what we really are. So when I sit in front of a TV set and view trash, I tend to rant and rave at what I'm seeing. Why don't we wake up? What I hear and see is a reflection of what's in me. Thus, my only corrective is to read a good book or otherwise cease to patronize such low-grade performances. Now, notice that many people say what we need to do is to regulate television. We need the government to come in here and regulate this for us. Now, isn't that censorship? I mean, if I were to say, I disapprove of that book that you're reading, wouldn't you say that's censorship? Now, I think a better solution to that would be, why don't you change channels? Now, we have a channel here, Channel 31, that I find particularly obnoxious. I find that it's dirty, permissive. It has qualities to it that I really abhor. So when I'm flipping through the channels, Channel 31 comes up. But I just keep right on going until I get to Channel 3 or 10 or 6 or 21, the channels that I view, the channels that I want. And in this way, I'm not censoring my neighbor, who evidently likes Channel 31, because if everybody had the same view of Channel 31 that I do, they wouldn't be on the air. They'd be off. Nobody would watch it. No advertiser would advertise on it. They'd be out of business. They would have to change their format. They'd have to change their programming. And after all, isn't that what the free marketplace and ideas do? Now, we have a thing here called Holocaust deniers. And Holocaust deniers deny that the Holocaust existed. And so the opposition comes out and says, that's a hate crime. Let's bring the coercive forces of government together. And if you deny the Holocaust, let's put you in prison and punish you. Isn't that censorship? I mean, come on. You know, if the majority can censor what you read, is that good for you? Maybe good for us. I mean, if I had my choice, I would throw that Channel 31 right off the air. And I'm sure that if somebody else had their choice, they'd throw PBS off the air. So here again, we've got our own vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear coming into play. This is autocracy. This is, we've got the coercive power, so we're going to use it for your good. The marketplace does not do that. The free marketplace leaves Channel 31 alone. The free marketplace leaves the First Amendment intact. Holocaust deniers have their place and they have their view. If you don't like it, counter it. But leave them alone. That's, after all, what free speech is all about. If you're going to have a free marketplace, you have to have free speech. Because somebody has to come out here and sell their fish. Somebody has to sell their coconuts, their bananas, their passion fruits, their huts. Everybody has to have a place out here in the marketplace to sell his goods. And when the rest of us reject your goods, then you're out of the marketplace. Not coerced. We didn't put a gun to your head and say, close down your pornographic Channel 31. We just said, we don't want to buy that. Let's try, for instance, this. Let's suppose that I come in with fish. And the fish that I come in with are particularly obnoxious fish. I mean, they taste bad, they're rotten, they don't taste good at all. Now, everybody here wants fish. And so all of a sudden, the sixth guy over here, who's so far unemployed, wakes up one day and says, you know, that old man Gordon over there, who provides the fish for all of us, is providing bad fish. But I, too, am a carpenter. I, too, can build a boat, and I, too, can learn how to fish. And so he goes out, and he brings in fresh fish, good fish, wholesome fish. And all of a sudden, I'm out of the fish business. Nobody wants to buy my fish. Not because somebody stuck a gun to my head or coerced me. Somebody else in the marketplace went out and produced a better product, maybe for less, fewer coconuts and fewer bananas. I'll give you two fish for a coconut. Gordon would only trade you one fish for a coconut. And that's where competition comes in. The marketplace works, and it's amoral. It doesn't decide good and bad and right and wrong. It doesn't decide morals. And this is where the religious people have fallen down on their job. They criticized the free enterprise system and said it hasn't brought about this moral utopia that we all desire, and the marketplace was never designed to bring about a moral utopia. It doesn't work that way. However, if you want morality, you'll do better with a free enterprise economy than you will with a top-down economy. And that's because the people that are out there can choose, and they can choose for themselves. And this opens the door for morality. So now, why don't you preachers start teaching us morality? Why don't you tell us what's wrong with Channel 31? And why it is that we ought not to watch it, why we ought not to patronize it, why it's bad for us, what would be better for us. Why don't you come into the marketplace, and why don't you sell something moral in place of that which is immoral? Instead of complaining about the Holocaust denier, why don't you come in here with your evidence, and why don't you prove that this Holocaust denier is wrong? Rather than censor him and throw him out of the marketplace by force, why don't you come into the marketplace and compete with him and prove that he's wrong? And then he'll disappear. He will leave the marketplace because there isn't any customers for what it is that he's selling, whether it's his ideas, his fish, his coconuts, or his morality. And all of a sudden, now the marketplace becomes a marketplace for morality, as well as immorality. Why don't you come in here and show us why morality is better than immorality? Why don't you show us how we're going to prosper more from a moral code of action or code of conduct than from an immoral code of conduct? That's what the marketplace does. It's a clearinghouse for ideas as well as for goods and services. Now, the market is but a response to a mirror of our desires. And once this harsh reality is grasped, the market becomes a disciplinary force. Let's elaborate. Say that a person desires, buys, and reads a filthy book. Were he to realize that what he's reading is a picture of what's in his own makeup, such a realization by itself would tend to change him for the better. The market would then reflect the improvement. But note that the market has no such effect on those who are oblivious to this fact. It's the knowledge of this character-revealing fact that makes of the market a disciplinary force. So I'm only trying to point out the market's potentiality in this respect. Instead of cursing evil, stay out of the market for it. The evil will cease to exist because we cease to patronize it. Trying to rid ourselves of trash by running to government for morality laws is like trying to minimize the effects of inflation by wage, price, and other controls. Both destroy the market that is the reflection of ourselves, and such tactics are at the intellectual level of mirror smashing. Because we don't like the image that we see in the mirror, let's break the mirror. attempts not to see ourselves as we are. The market's potentiality as a disciplinary force is thereby removed. To slay this faithful and moral servant is to blindfold, deceive, and hoodwink ourselves. Next to forswearing a faith in an infinite intelligence over and beyond our own minds, denying the market is to erase the best point of reference that man has. So much for the first somewhat unexplored possibility of the market as a disciplinary force. Now, secondly, man is imperfect. So, in the second place, this cannot be explained unless we're aware of our numerous shortcomings, of how narrow our virtues and talents really are. Everyone, and no exceptions allowed. So let's take, for example, the greatest mathematical genius who ever lived. He's a giant in his field. And yet, without question, he's a know-nothing in countless other ways. And this goes for outstanding generals, chemists, physicists, scientists, of whatever brand or stripe. No one ever gets more than an infinitesimal peek at the cosmic scheme, at the overall luminosity, even at himself. We must see that the biggest among us is tiny. And one who denies this about himself is displaying the greatest ignorance of all. He doesn't even know how little he knows. And if we wish to know anything, we must resign ourselves to being ignorant of much. Now reflect on this human reality. An imperfect man, particularly on the more imaginative and brilliant individuals among us, while they may possess an outstanding and remarkable appetite or two, or aptitude or two, they too are daydreamers. And if only I had $1 million is a dream that flashes across everybody's minds. Many of these specialists want above all else to pursue their own peculiar bent, whether it be going to the moon, genetic alteration of other human beings, releasing the atom's energy, or whatever it may be. Knowing so much about one thing and so little about everything else, they are unable to know what effect their ambitions, if achieved, might have on the whole human situation as a whole. Just as a baby with a stick of dynamite and a match is totally unaware of what the consequences might be. Now, the lamentable fact is that scientists, pseudoscientists, and other technologists have been given a wishing well. It's called the federal grab bag. They thus are encouraged to carry out any experiment that their hearts desire without let or hindrance, leaving aside the destruction of our economy by inflation, featured in the grab bag's financing. They are alarmingly endangering all of the people on the entire earth, even the earth itself, and primarily because they suffer no restraining, no disciplinary forces. Their passions and ambitions are let on the loose. It's government that is financing all of these loose experiments. It was government that financed the atomic bomb. Government finances these weapons of mass destruction. You see, in a free marketplace, there are no weapons of mass destruction because there isn't any market for it. Let's think about it. When was the last time you went out into the marketplace looking for a 20 megaton hydrogen bomb? You know, I never have, and I never will. What am I going to do with it after I find one? The only purpose for a 20 megaton hydrogen bomb is to kill people, and it's to kill people more effectively and more of them. It's for the purpose of dropping on a city like London and killing 10 million people. That's the purpose for it. Now, there are some people out there that would like to do that. The marketplace won't support that. You have to have socialism. You have to have communism. You have to have coercion. The marketplace wouldn't support it. If you and I and all of the rest of the Americans supported the free market system in place of our 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, we would have more peace. How many of you people out there want to buy a war in Afghanistan? How many of you people out there even give a rat's ass whether Afghanistan lives or dies or exists or doesn't? I would venture a guess that most of you people listening to me right now, if I showed you a map of the world and said, show me Afghanistan, you couldn't find it with both hands under a bright light. The marketplace won't support war. The marketplace doesn't want war. There aren't any customers for war. So in order to get us to go to war, we have to have a military draft. You have to have coercion. You've got to have a taxing policy that takes your money away from you to support this war whether you want it or not. You have to have an electoral process that puts in those leaders in office, whether you elect them or whether they just come in by force. You've got to have something outside the free marketplace. You can't have war with a free market economy. There aren't any customers for it. Nobody wants to buy it. You've got to enforce this on people. And of course, the people that want to buy a war are the people that make money from it. You know, people that benefit from war are the military-industrial complex, politicians, people that are selling and contracting with the government. Halliburton profits from war. Kellogg, Brown, and Root profit from war. Those people, their stockholders, their shareholders, their CEOs, those people want war. I wouldn't blame them. People that build nuclear submarines and people that build aircraft carriers, my God, all those people want war. It's good for business. War makes money. But the broad majority of people, you know, if you walked out and said, would you like to buy some war today? What's the price? Oh, we're just taking about 17% of everything that you create and produce. And we'll put you down for war. And then we'll put a little sidelight on it. After you've bought and paid for it, we'll let you go over and participate in it. You can just get into it right up to your elbows. How many people want to do that? So if you were to ask the question of 300 million Americans, I think you'd probably find 5 or 10 million that would want to buy a war, and the other 290 million would say, no, we think we'll pass. And as a result of that, you wouldn't have war, because the marketplace won't support it. It doesn't have anything to do with morality. We're not concerned with whether war is moral or immoral. War is expensive, costs a lot, doesn't do much for us. I'd rather spend my money on a carnival cruise than I would on a troop ship to Iraq. So the carnival cruise being a whole lot more fun than a crowded troop ship, most people would buy the carnival cruise in opposition to the troop ship. And that's just the way life is. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Now again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network, or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about free market discipline. As it relates to war, nobody would buy it. If everybody in the world practiced free market discipline, the free market and our free enterprise system, we wouldn't have war. We wouldn't have pornography either. We wouldn't have, in short, most of the evils that people are complaining that the free market system has not provided. And that's because the free market system has never been allowed to work from the Garden of Eden to today freely and uninterrupted, anywhere on planet Earth. It is always opposed. Always. Always has been, is now, and will always be. And that's because the powers that be, that is, the Bill Gates, the Warren Buffetts, the politicians, the military-industrial complex, these people do not make money off of the free market or the free enterprise system. The military-industrial complex would go the way of the buggy whip and the buggy if the free market were left to itself. These big banks that our government is busy bailing out, at your expense, by the way, if you take a look at the average Joe Sixpack and ask him the question, would you like to spend half of everything that you create and produce for the rest of your life to bail out J.P. Morgan and Citibank? Just ask. Is that the way you want to spend your money? Or would you rather spend your money on a Carnival cruise or a swimming pool in your backyard? I think that's a no-brainer. So the powers that be, that is the banks, the politicians, the military-industrial complex, they have a vested interest in socialism. They've got a vested interest in the destruction of the free enterprise system. They want to stamp it out of existence. Now, the free enterprise system is commonly called the black market. So when you get a particularly repressive regime in place, like the communists in the Soviet Union under Joe Stalin, or the Germans under Adolf Hitler, where they're just going to stamp it out, a black market comes up in its place. Even though the militarists officially stamp out free enterprise, it doesn't. It just goes underground, like the marijuana sales in the United States. The government's attempt to stamp out marijuana is a total bust, a total failure. And you have what you call here in this country the war on drugs. Boys and girls, that's a lie. It's a misnomer. There's no war on drugs in the United States. Everybody in this country, there's 300 million people live in this country. There isn't anybody in this country that's opposed to drugs. Name one. I can't name one. George Bush isn't opposed to drugs. Barack Obama is not opposed to drugs. Rexall isn't opposed to drugs. Nobody wants to stamp out drugs. They want to stamp out the competition to their drug sales. That's what the art, that's what the issue is all about. Stamping out marijuana, cocaine, crack, and heroin is on the part of government and pharmaceutical industries and medical doctors who are in competition, selling their own marijuana under their own brand name, selling their own cocaine under their own brand name, and they get six times more for it. I've pointed that out. If the marketplace were allowed to work, let's go back and take a look. What kind of a drug problem did you have in the United States of America? What kind of a war on drugs did you have when Teddy Roosevelt was president in 1905? The answer was zero. Was there marijuana? Certainly. Was there cocaine? Absolutely. You remember Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, and Sherlock Holmes was an opium addict. Okay. There were opium addicts. So what? What do you care? How does that affect you? There are people out here that smoke. Now, as long as the guy is smoking in his own air and he's not polluting my air, what do I care if this guy smokes? And this is the basis of this thing called free enterprise. It's the basis of what we call libertarian philosophy. And libertarian philosophy says, well, if it's not hurting you, what do you care if that guy does it? Now, I personally am opposed to opium. I don't think opium is good. I don't think that you ought to be using it. But I'm not in favor of telling you that you should not use opium. Now, we didn't outlaw marijuana in this country until 1937. Congress got their dander up and they said, well, we're going to outlaw marijuana. They did that for the alcohol industry. You see, during the years of Prohibition from 1920 to 35, the people in this country, when they couldn't get alcohol, they went to something else. And marijuana was there, and you could grow it in your own backyard, and so a lot of people started smoking dope. Well, now, the Roosevelt administration says, well, we ain't making any money on this marijuana. See, marijuana is a real problem. Anybody can grow the stuff. It's a weed. Anybody can grow marijuana. But not everybody can make Jack Daniel's whiskey. So the Jack Daniel's distillers went to Congress and they said, we need to stop this marijuana. And we don't want to do it in the name of monopoly. We need to do it in the name of medical science or the health, welfare, and the safety of the population, the people. We're just concerned about the people. Hey, I'm from the government and I'm just here to protect you. So they stamped out marijuana. That's to boost alcohol sales. Nothing more, nothing less. So the alcohol producers went into Congress to get the police power of the state to interfere in the free marketplace. Now, there wasn't any problem. You know, you guys that want to sell alcohol, get out there and sell it. Go out there and tell people how much better your alcohol is than their marijuana. But, hey, it's a lot easier if we can go in here and stamp out the competition by the police power of the state. That's the socialist way. Stamp out your opponents. This is the way that the hate mongers, I call them hate mongers now, brand the Holocaust deniers as being hate mongers. Instead of coming out to the marketplace and saying, hey, let's compete fairly and squarely. Let's come out and present our cases. No. The Holocaust promoters, they come out and they say, no, let's use the police power of the state to stamp out the Holocaust deniers. Let's pass laws and make it a hate crime. And if we catch you doing that, then we're going to punish you. We'll throw you in prison. Well, hell, all that does is it just puts it underground. You're not stamping anything out. So the Holocaust denier, and I, I got to tell you, the day some guy sent me some CDs, DVDs. And what they do is they force it underground. Now it circulates probably wider than it would have if you'd left it alone. And that's because it becomes the fruit of the poisonous tree. It's like telling Adam and Eve, don't eat off of that tree. Eat off of all these trees in the garden. Here's 40,000 trees in the garden. Just one over here. Don't eat off of that one. And what is the one tree that everybody now wants to eat off of? Well, how come I can't eat off that tree? I mean, if you just looked at it pragmatically, the chances of anybody eating off that tree were 40,000 to 1. It wasn't very likely that anybody was going to accidentally go eat off that tree anyway until you pointed it out and said, see that tree over there? That one's a different tree from all the other 40,000. You got 39,999 trees in here that you can eat off of, but that one you can't. And all of a sudden, it just puts it right up there front and center. So you people out there that think that you're doing your side some big favor because you think you're going to stamp out the Holocaust deniers, you got your heads up the wrong end. That's what's happened with marijuana. It costs you a lot of money. This war on drugs. Hell, you didn't have a problem with marijuana until you outlawed it. That's my point. The reason you got a problem with marijuana and illegal drugs is because you outlawed them. If you let the marketplace come into play, what would happen is that instead of all of you drug addicts out there going to your medical doctor and getting a prescription for marijuana, cocaine, and heroin and paying six times as much, you'd go to the same doctor, get your prescription, and it would cost you one-sixth as much, which means that more people could afford more marijuana, more heroin, and more cocaine, which would exacerbate the production of the above, and we would have more of it at less cost. But that's not what government wants, and that's not what the pharmaceutical industry wants. So all we're actually arguing over here in the marketplace is the price of it, price and competition. That's what it boils down to. Now, the marketplace itself would probably bring about a lesser use of all of these illegal drugs. As soon as the thing is legal, remember I told you a story about my dad? I'm age 12, and he takes me into the kitchen. He says, son, I'm going to teach you how to drink. I'm 12 years old. And my dad pours out a highball, and he says, here, you know, it's you and me drink. And he explained to me, he said, you know, you're 12 years old, and pretty soon your pimply-faced punk friends are going to be drinking, and they're going to be encouraging you to drink, and I want you to learn how from me. I don't want you to learn about alcohol and smoking and whorehouses and sex from your pimply-faced punk friends. I want you to learn it from me. I'm your dad. My dad taught me about smoking. He taught me about cigarettes. He taught me about pipes and cigars. He taught me about vodka, whiskey, beer, wine. He taught me about whores, whorehouses, sex, marriage, reproduction. My dad did that. He insisted that I learn all these things, not from some stranger in high school, not in sex education class, not by experimentation with my fraternity friends. He said, I am going to teach you this. And so with me, alcohol was never a big deal. And so while my friends were all sneaking around and drinking beer and getting drunk out at the drive-in, I was drinking Pepsi-Cola. I never did care much for whiskey. It tastes terrible. There isn't anybody who would drink whiskey over Coca-Cola. I mean, you'd have to be so spaced out on something to choose Jack Daniels over Coca-Cola. There's something wrong with your taste buds. Now, when it comes to the effect of the alcohol over the Coca-Cola. Now, the Jack Daniels has it all over Coke. I don't deny it. But I never became an alcoholic, and I never drank myself to death, you know, with binge drinking. I knew and understood how to use it. And I've always used it in moderation. I use it, you know, once in a while I take a drink, once in a while I drink a beer, but it doesn't taste all that good, and it isn't all that good for me, and so I just decided, because it's a marketplace decision. You see, boys and girls, we can buy beer any day of the week, can't we? I mean, come on, what's the big deal? You know, once you get to be 21, what's the big attraction? That's why the marketplace has a discipline that enforces itself upon all of us. It has an influence upon all of us, whether we like to admit it or not. Now, as a disciplinary force over wild aspiration, the President of the United States, a member of Congress, a bureaucrat, is not only less effective than the market, but he's less effective than any single buyer or seller in the marketplace. Every individual, or any individual, an individual, when a government official considers only how much of other people's money should be spent, the motivation in this instance favors spending over economizing. And the same individual in the free market considers how much of his own property he's willing to put out on the line. The motivation in this instance is self-interest. Hey, just plain greed. Just plain greed. That's my motivation. And so, if you just ask me, well, would I rather tithe or pay income tax? Just my greed says, oh, I'd rather pay a 10% tithe to God than I would to pay a 40% tax to the government. Hell, that's a no-brainer. And this is tough. Ambition, as silly as tracking the meanderings of polar bears by a Nimbus satellite, stand a chance for satisfaction when a grab bag made up of other people's money is readily at hand. Let me just pause that for a second. There are people out there that are tracking the migrations of polar bears by satellite. Let me ask you this. How many of you people would like to buy into that? How would you like to buy stock in a company that advertises, we track the meanderings of polar bears? I wouldn't. I don't want to buy into that. But now my government does. My government says, well, we want to support that. So we're going to take your tax dollars and we're going to support Professor so-and-so over here or Dr. such-and-such. And we're going to go out here and we're going to track all this. You ever wonder why that there's a problem with the extinction of polar bears and there's a problem with the extinction of wolves and a problem with the extinction of this and that and another thing? Well, because you got a bunch of special interest groups over there that are promoting the extinction of polar bears. There wasn't a problem with polar bears until we started tracking them and counting them and micromanaging them. If you just leave them alone, they'd probably get along. You know, the damn bears, according to the evolution, has been here for millions of years, and all of a sudden in the last 50 or 75, we got this big polar bear problem. Huh? And here's what the bottom line is. See, little Timmy is born in Brooklyn. And he goes to a government school in the first grade, and he stays there until he's in the 12th grade. And they tell him, now you got to go to college, little Timmy. Now, what do you want to be? And he says, well, I want to be a biologist. Okay, so they send him to college, and they train him as a biologist. Now, he goes out into the marketplace. How many of you people out there want to buy the services of a biologist? Come on now. How many of you out there? When was the last time you went to the Yellow Pages and said, oh, my God, I have to find B biologist. I need the services of a biologist. Oh, my God, I can't live another day without my biologist. I have to have a biologist to count polar bears. Huh? When was the last time? The answer was never, and is never going to be. So little Timmy over here is unemployed. He's trained. He's got a college degree. Hell, maybe he's got a master's. Perhaps he's written his doctorate now. And he is the world's preeminent biologist. Okay, but how in the hell does that benefit anybody out here in the marketplace? The answer is, that poor slob will starve to death in the free marketplace. There isn't anybody out there that wants to buy his services. There isn't anybody out there that gives a rat's ass as to how many polar bears there are. It's only little Timmy. So the government comes along and they hire little Timmy and they put him into the Department of Agriculture, Bureau of Biology. What is he going to do? Well, let's find something for him. Let's make some work for him. We have to have employment. Timmy has to have a job. He's well qualified. So let's create a biology department and Department of Agriculture tracking the migrations of polar bears. So little Timmy now has to justify his job. So he goes out and he counts the polar bears. Oh my God, there's 75 less polar bears this year than there was last year. So he writes up a research paper. He comes back and reports to his boss. 75 fewer polar bears. His boss says, why do you think there's 75 fewer polar bears? It must be global warming. It must be the encroachment of mankind on Hudson's Bay. It must be the melting of the polar ice cap. Okay, so write that down. Well, now let's publicize that. So we call CBS and we say, come on over here to the Department of Agriculture. We want to report a news story. And little Timmy gets up in front of the news people and he says, well, let me tell you what's going on. The global warming and the encroachment of man and melting of the polar ice cap is causing the polar bear population to decrease. Boys and girls, except for the time you went to your zoo, you didn't even know polar bears existed. And except for an odd Eskimo or two that eats polar bears, you know, if they all died in the morning, it wouldn't mean a hell of a lot. I mean, you know, come on. You've got extinction on planet Earth that's been going on for thousands of years under natural selection, and there are species that have just disappeared, like dinosaurs. Are you suggesting that the dinosaurs disappeared because man overhunted Tyrannosaurus Rex and brought him to destruction? Huh? Oh, come on. Let's wake up and smell some coffee here. Little Timmy's job is the direct result of the coercive power of the police, power of the state, stealing the money from you as a worker, building automobiles in Detroit and sending it off to Washington so they can send it off to little Timmy, wherever his laboratory is, and East, you know, such and such. And that's why little Timmy has a job. And that's why the marketplace is a discipline to that. So if we would leave the coercion of government out, we wouldn't have a military-industrial complex. And we didn't have a military-industrial complex in 1848. Didn't need one, didn't want one, and we didn't have one. And we got along nicely without it. How do you like that? All right, so there we are with free market discipline. Let me give you a name and number here again. Remember, this is Foundations of Liberty. That's the name of the publication. And it's put out by the MacArthur Institute at 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, 61244. And their phone number is 309-796-1485. Once more, that's area code 309-796-1485. Hey, I'm about out of time again. I'm going to have to give you a reminder here that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And Good night, friends.